episode of Write Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing, presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association, based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Dawn Major. I'm a Broadleaf board member, and I am thrilled to welcome Daniel Wallace. Daniel has authored seven novels, including Big Fish, which was adapted and released as a movie by Tim Burton, and then later into a Broadway musical. He's written and illustrated a children's book, Cat's Pajamas, and a memoir, This Isn't Going to End Well, that I'm actually currently reading. I'm listening to it on Audible. It's a tragic story of the loss of your, you know, brother-in-law, William Neely, to suicide. And I have to take it in stages. Like, it's not something that you could just, I don't know how if I were reacted to it differently if I read it in a book, like in paper form, but like listening to it, I'm like, okay, I got to take a break, just knowing what's happening, but what happens ultimately, but I think is a valuable piece of work. I'm really glad you decided to share it. But today we're going to be talking about your collection of flash fiction, Beneath the Moon and Long Dead Stars. So what I wanted to start with is just start with the cover, because I understand that this was a painting called Suburban Night that your daughter painted, Lillian Bailey Hoover, who I'm following now. And I just think it's so cool when family can collaborate. So obviously you have this personal connection, but how did you guys land on this image? Was it something like, did you have her paint it specifically for your book, or was it something that just fit perfectly with the book?
She has her own website, like I guess everybody does, and has a bunch of her paintings on there. I wanted to use something of hers that she had done. Uh-huh. Part of the real pleasure of doing a book like this with a smaller press is that you're allowed much more freedom to be a part of the process. Mm-hmm. And larger publishers, they're kind of selfish with the process, and the author is on the outside looking in. But with this book, I got to work with Ross White, who's the owner and editor at Bull City Press, and we worked together on the cover, on the font, on the paper that we used, on the design of the book, how big it was going to be, and I wanted Lillian to have the cover. So we looked at a bunch of her paintings and thought that this excerpt, it's really a part of a painting, because her paintings are actually rather large, mm-hmm. was perfect for the general mood of the book, I think.
Yeah. I agree. And I mean, even the title Suburban Night, I thought you might have commissioned her to do this for the, because it really did fit so perfectly. And I know all art is subjective. So I don't know, am I seeing this correctly, that this is a window that I'm looking into a window? Okay. I just want to make sure I got that right. I thought it was great, because I'm looking into a window, and then there's this other look like it's a dark window that, you know, you just see what's the next. And I just like that whole sense of, you know, the Suburban Night title, but I see like a good chunk of the stories are set at night and in suburbia. And I've gotten to the part where you're really talking about your writing and your memoir, and you mentioned Raymond Carver. And I thought Raymond Carver, I also thought Cheever when I read this. I felt like there's elements of both those writers. And then that sense of longing for something that suburban landscapes are somehow missing. And for me, the latter was like a very suburban-esque story. That's one of my favorite stories, by the way. I thought it's just a funny story. But it's also surprisingly bleak. And when I got this collection, it was not what I expected. And in fact, I want to ask you about this, because when I sent you the interview for Southerly Review, and I hadn't heard back because your email got lost and wherever it gets lost. And in the beginning, I referred to this book as an exorcism. And I thought, oh my God, I just totally pissed him off. He's never going to respond to me. But I did that. I thought of that because I thought it was such a deviation from what we are all accustomed to, more whimsical, magical realism. So would you agree that it's an exorcism, or what would you call it?
I don't know that I would go that far. I do think that this genre of flash fiction or short fiction pocket fiction. It's called All Sorts of Things, and really all it is are stories that take place rather quickly. Some of them, I think there's one story in there that's 180 words long. Most of them are around 1,000, 1,200 words long. And there are a couple of longer ones. But what they do, they do a lot of things, but what they do for a writer is allow him or her to take on different voices and take on different themes and ideas, because you don't have to maintain them for that long. Could I write a novel using one of the voices in these stories and stick with it for the years that it would take to write it? I don't think so, Lovely. So you can come to this book expecting a voice that you might be familiar with through something like Big Fish. But there is a, I think, a wide range of stories and voices available here and available to me as a writer and to anybody who wants to get into this sort of story, to experiment, to explore different parts of yourself, ideas that you have. It's really freeing.
Yeah, and then it's over. It's like I am just not a novel writer. I don't think that anyone go, well, so actually that's not true. A lot of people go, oh, I'm going to write a novel, and I don't understand how anyone can sit down and go, I'm going to write a novel. I'm like, I write mosaic novels, so they're linked narratives, and that's my only way I can approach the idea of writing a novel. It's kind of tricky, trick my way into it. But one other thing I want to comment about the settings and the comparison, like why I said this is a deviation, is in your other books, we found sort of this hyperbolic, almost a celebration of the South, even with this dark undercurrent. Certainly, there that's there. And I want this to be one of those high church kind of questions. But I've, and it's going to sound like a high church question, but I thought, is because it's the suburbia, it could be anywhere, you know, and not all of them are, you don't know exactly if they're set in the South. There are a couple that I definitely know, like Welcome to Monroe. Okay, that's the South. But I looked at it sort of as of a disappearing South. I mean, are we just turning into one giant suburban neighborhood? What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that.
So I told you it was a high church question.
Yeah, I was raised in a suburbia that I felt like in many ways could be deposited anywhere and without a lot of changes. I didn't grow up at a country club or in a at a school that was particularly didn't feel like it was in the South. If you travel through the South now, there's if you're coming to a town, there's a circle around the town of big box stores and fast food and gas stations, and that's obviously something that's been happening for a long time, but now it's even more so, and you can't go anywhere without experiencing first this outer band of that sort of thing of retail, really this infected by retail. So I do feel like that in part is the case, and in reference to these stories, I think that my impulse is to create or to tell stories that could take place anywhere, that aren't fixed in place, even though traditionally Southern writers are really obsessed with place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The places in these stories are much more specific and contained than a traditional Southern story. So I think of myself, I don't think of myself as anything really particularly except a writer, but I don't think of myself as a Southern writer, even though I've lived all my life
Ah.
in the South and I've actually never lived anywhere else. So
Yeah.
I have to be a Southern writer in a sense, because this is where I've existed for 66 years, but I don't identify that way.
And see, and I think that so most people or most of your readers would identify you as a Southern writer. I mean, I do. I mean, probably because of the settings and the sense of place, where this one does definitely is not. I wouldn't. This could have been, someone else. It didn't have to have. If it didn't have your name on, I wouldn't have thought, oh, Southern writer. But there's something to that. I wondered. This is an off the cuff kind of question because it's made me think about what you said about identifying as a Southern writer. I know when I a couple years ago was up in New York and I went to like all the kind of famous bookstores, and I had this. I didn't. I knew what was going to happen, but I sort of deliberately did that just to aggravate myself because I knew they weren't going to have Southern writers up there. And so I'm like, oh, where's your Southern Gothic section or something? Where's your Southern writer section? And I mean, besides Faulkner and King's Oliver, I mean, there's like maybe two writers in there. Maybe you're up there, but what's up with that? I mean, do we have to stick with our own? I feel like everyone in the South, like we're just trying so desperately to, in some ways, sort of fit in with the rest of the big top publishers. And you've infiltrated that in terms of your career. So what do you do as a Southern writer? How do you reach beyond the South?
I have no idea. I just write, and once I send it out there, I'm really not in control of what happens to it. Certainly, I'm not trying to do anything that, shaping my stories to think, oh, this will be more popular than this, or this will make it in New York. In the South, I don't know, having never lived anywhere else, what it's like in Portland or San Francisco or Albany, New York. But I do think that there are regional writers everywhere. The South has a bigger hold on a larger territory than other places. But there are locally famous, semi-locally famous writers that we all know of. And you're in Atlanta, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Atlanta.
You have a lot of writers in Atlanta, and a lot of them, as we have in Chapel Hill, really are contained to North Carolina, as as far as their name is known. And they're people, writers I know that first of all, very proud to be a North Carolina writer, but there is a Southern quality of Southern novels sometimes that's off-putting to other people who aren't familiar with it. And but we can, say the same about any
Yeah,
kind of
true.
writing.
Yeah. When you know what I said in that one interview, I was like, you always have to have a dog story. And my other sign of a Southern writer or a Southern written book is chifarobe. You has the word
Yeah.
chifarobe. Look, you'll always see it now. I'm like, I didn't grow up using the word chifarobe. So I'm like, oh, I know I'm reading someone from the South because that is something it always shows up. I don't know why. It's just like
Do you
that.
know why it shows up all the time?
Why?
Because it was a big part of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah, it's in there. So everybody just uses that term. Why didn't you say wardrobe? Isn't it the same thing as a wardrobe? A
Yes,
moire.
it's exactly the same, but it's not in To Kill a Mockingbird, where he says, I went into her house to bust up her chifarobe. And that is how he's convicted of a murder he didn't commit. And so I think that word is a when it's used, is an echo and a reference in some way to kill a mockingbird.
Thank you for enlightening me because I really didn't know because I that wasn't a word because I'm from California originally and then I lived in Missouri for a spell. So I remember I came down to the South and I was came down here as a freshman in high school and everybody was saying, hey, and I when in Missouri when you say hey, it's like almost like something's wrong. Hey, look out for that. And I didn't know what they were saying. So Shifra was always like, what is this Shifra thing? But I should have been better with my literary knowledge of realizing that I'd not connect the dots there. Okay, so let's get back to the book, and I'm still fixated on the light on this image because there's so much. It's very shadowy. There's so many shadow windows are very symbolic also, and there's all this light and dark imagery throughout. And I mean, there's overlying theme of voyeurism. Your characters are always like looking into light windows, or in passing by, they see some a window light, their neighbors, or they're watching for someone. And there's sort of this sense of like wonderment of what's going on the other side of that window, or even a comparison to their own life. So, why are all your characters peeping Toms? No, I mean, or voyeurs. They're kind of peeping Toms, though. Some of them. Some are
Well,
worse than others.
yeah, I think I'm guilty as charged. Used to walk around, take a walk at night, and watch lives that were happening openly inside with the lights on, and they have no idea that anybody is looking. But
Don't have the binoculars out though.
and you can watch the normal, really non-expressive in many ways, but evocative lives of how people live who really have to know that through the frame of this window, they're in a silent movie for anybody to see. I don't know if I said it in the interview that we had, but I feel like the best advice that you can give a young writer is to pay attention.
You did say that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's one aspect of it is seeing how people live in their natural habitat. When you're, this is not really, me, completely, because we're in this false kind of moment, and looking at the computer, talking to each other. But were you to see me without me knowing that you were looking at me, it would be a different person. And that's important to see as a writer how people are, and just in very minor ways, right? How, who clears the table? How do they do it? How long did it, what does it look like when the man is standing and the woman is sitting, and then the woman is standing and the man is sitting? Whatever it is, there's an image that is can be important, and can, if not important, bring life to a story, because you, the reader, know it's real. You, the reader, know that this is taken from the reality that we all know in one way or another. So yeah, I do think that a peeping Tom, I am going to, object on legal basis that, but a curious person, who's not breaking any laws, sure.
I'm teasing you with that. You're not a peeping
I
Tom.
know, I know.
I kind of, I am too. I live smack in the middle of downtown, between Midtown. I'm like in between Midtown and downtown, and so I'm in Mid-Rise. And I mean, I have access to so much to like look down the street. Just I can sit there and just listen to people as the craziness. Every single day, I will see some. If I leave this my condo, I will see something insane. And I've gotten so accustomed to it that I forget to even tell my husband, like, oh, I saw this guy just standing in the middle of the road, completely naked, taking a bath. And he wasn't homeless. He just seemed like he wanted to be taking a bath in front of people, like just strange, odd things. And they're sort of curious things that happen. They blur together. So I forget them, like, oh, I should write that down for something else. But it just sticks up there in that big blob of whatever, But and thinking about, I want to backtrack to, because you said something about the characters, almost like the window is a frame, And so you don't know what's going behind there. And then with like the first story, which I'm still a little upset about, I've read it about three times. I mean, it's only what you imagine happened. I don't want to give away too much. Just imagining what happened, you know, a dog story where you imagine the worst. But you called the perfect name, and the character, I'm gonna call him character, is nameless. But I didn't, you probably are aware of this, maybe you're not, but if you go through this collection, most of the characters are nameless. And do you think that's, is that just you? Is that because you're looking on people, like at people in windows, and you have no idea what their names are? Not specifically that image, but just in general, like, is it, you know, these little snapshots of people, you don't know their names, but most of the time you don't name them. And I didn't know if that was a product of flash fiction or Big Bang Fiction, as you've coined it. I'll use that and give you credit for
Yeah, thank you.
that.
Popularizing that phrase, which has
I'll use it. I'm like Daniel Wallace, Big Bang Fiction.
yeah, here you go, everybody. Big Bang Fiction. Well, so as a writer, you have to look at every story and decide what's important, what details are important, what do you need to tell this story, and sometimes names are not necessary. There's one story where a name is very necessary to the plot of the story.
Are you referring to Welcome to Monroe?
No, actually, I was referring to the road is covered in limpid roses, something
Oh,
like
yeah.
that.
Oh,
His name
and there's
is
Lorelei, Sweetie
Hamburger.
Pie. Actually, there are a lot of stories where the name is very important, but then there's these a lot of stories where there's no names.
Yeah,
So
there's absolutely
it's
no names. They're people with a disease that's never named.
Yeah.
In the book Big Fish, the father is dying of something, but you never know what
Yeah.
it is. You never know what the thing is. You can make an assumption about what it is, but you don't know. And you don't really need to know. I
You
don't.
know. Well, this is something else. Talking about Big Fish, since you brought up Big Fish. This isn't really a Big Fish question, though. It's more of a just a narrative question, how you write your choose to write your narratives. Because like in Big Fish and then Mr. Sebastian, the Negro Magicians, and even your memoir, I noticed something. I don't know, am I making all this up? Or just go along with it. Okay. I noticed something. I felt that those stories had this effect of Nick Carraway and The Great Gatsby, and how you have this first person narrator who's telling a story about someone else. And even in your memoir, it's like that. And you learn something about you, a lot about you in your memoir, but it's not necessarily a story about William Neely. It is, and it isn't. You know, and that seems something that you gravitate to. Has anyone asked you about
No,
that? Well, you do it. No, you
you're
really
absolutely right.
It's like almost you start out like it's almost like you're starting at the end of something, right? Or this is my take on it. You start at telling the story at the end of something, and then it's and then there's all these stories from other people, like for Mr. Sebastian, the Negro Magician, it's which is similar to Big Fish, and where these little snippets, right? But it's told from his circus family, right? And then and then the stories of, you know, and Bloom, and then yeah, it's really very much like this telling from that perspective, but also telling the narrator story.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
So, are you going to have to ponder on that one some more?
I think that we can't help but invest our books and our characters with ourselves. There's just no way around it. And I'm really good proof of that because I go very far afield in a narrative sense and working with elements of magical realism or invention that is not of this world, but I think in my real life, I very much prefer to be on the periphery as opposed to in the middle of things. So I think there's a difference between being a main character and a protagonist in a book, although that distinction is not always made. I think, and this isn't going to end well. My brother-in-law is the protagonist. In a way, I'm the main character because it's through my consciousness. His story is only important in the co context of this book by what happens to me, because
Isn't it? Yeah.
it would be a completely different story if I was just recounting his very interesting life. But it would be a much different story, and I think less important. And not because it's about me, but because understanding other people isn't as valuable without understanding them in the context of how they affect others in their life. Their actions aren't discrete to themselves. It's much, the ripples are very wide, and
That's a large wave, obviously, that hit you. That was massive. But I wondered about that. I know this is, I'm gonna keep back going back to the collection, but and I'm not finished with the memoir. There, you had so much self-doubt about your writing in there. And I think we all feel like this imposter syndrome, but it almost felt like you were, don't know, I could be wrong, like you didn't feel like you had the right to write until you've had so much experience. And then here's this person that you or is in your life who is just full of experience, one experience after another. It's almost like he brought you to writing in a way. I don't know if that's true or if that's accurate. What do you think about that? But
oh, he absolutely was a mentor, whether he knew it or not, and I don't think he knew it or cared, but his life was inspirational to me because not only did he have an interesting life and an active life and one where he was really involved in it, he lived he also took that experience and he translated it into 10 books.
yeah.
And was incredibly talented and creative, and he worked so hard and made money from it, lived on it for years. And that to me is inspirational as a young writer, not knowing whether it's possible. How crazy an idea is it to say, I want to be a writer?
Oh, it is. It
It's
is.
crazy, it's to say that to somebody. You rarely get a good response. You rarely get the response that you would like if
Oh,
you
I've
something
been there.
said. It's like saying, I'd really I want to be an astronaut.
I'll do that tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll start on that. I'll start on that tomorrow. But to know somebody that's successful, to know somebody who's published, I think that's really valuable to a young writer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was very inspirational to you, but I was kind of curious about in this collection about, well, I mean, there's two in particular very super dark to me, which is How to Build a Coffin and Welcome to Monroe. And I think the reason they were so effective, I mean, well, they're just so effective. One, because you chose to write them in a second person point of view. A second person point of view always just, I don't know. It's just if it's done well, it really it just knocks you down. Now, for me, as a short story writer, I'll write something in first person and I'm like, oh, this isn't working. So I'll write it the same story in third person. And I'm like, that's not working. Then I'll go back and write it in first person. I mean, and I just keep on going back and forth until I find the right thing. Do you do that? With those stories, specifically these stories, did you know I'm going to write these in second person point of view? Or did you write them in a different point of view and then go, oh, second will work better? Or do you do that in general, like experiment with the point of view?
I have done that. I have written a big chunk of a book and then gone back and changed first to third, and past to present.
Yeah, oh, I hate that one. Because it's hard to catch those things.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's difficult to revise a book when you're revising it from third to first, past to present. It's very, very difficult. So, I can't remember which book that I did that with, but I think with these two stories, they had to be in the second person.
Oh, yeah.
But again, I think responding to a statement that you made earlier, which is, I don't know how people sit down and write a novel. I've never, ever sat down to write a novel. The stories keep going, really. There, one story leads to another, and they slowly over time just don't stop. And I would never be able to sit down and say, I'm going to write a novel.
No way.
It's no way. It's to that's the beginning of a 3, 4, 5 year commitment that you're making. So it's you can't do that. I can't do that. Maybe some people can do that. I don't
People
know.
do it. They like I would be like, I'm not gonna do it. I know I'm just like what comes out, but
Yeah, and I think in How to Build a Coffin, I think that's told as when it's when you have a story that is really told as directions, right? And this is what it is. It's a guy talking to the people that are going to be using his directions to do what he's doing. So this naturally, I think, comes out as second person. The Welcome to Monroe. I think started in the second person, and I think that the telling in the second person is what created the story in a way that its second person can be so haunting.
It is.
You
That
know,
one sticks with me.
yeah, yeah, I know, and it's interesting. I mean, I really do like that story, but I don't know if the collection would be better without it. I don't know. There's so many stories in here that it's easy to second guess yourself when you come back.
Oh, it absolutely belongs in there. I think the one I didn't, I never really quite got. What is that one? I keep on, I'm still curious about it. Maybe I need to read it a few more times. The Men in the Woods. That one's sort of magical to me. The one where the wife tells, they sees those guys coming. I'm like, why are these guys doing this? What is this about? What is that about? I still haven't quite figured that one out. I'm not saying it doesn't belong in the collection. I don't quite get that one.
Well, so we can talk about it. There's story, The Men in the Woods. They're these men who upper middle class men who have been sent from their homes by their wives live in the woods now. And at one point, they go up to somebody's house to ask if they could use the phone. And when the character's wife finds out about this, she is upset and asks her husband to go down to the men in the woods and tell them not to do that anymore. And when he does go down there, then his wife locks him out and turns off all the lights and goes to bed. So he becomes
He
one of them.
becomes them at, I don't know, I didn't get that. I just thought they were, but I almost saw them as these little like barbarians. It took me back a little bit further in time. I almost didn't see it as a modern story, but I'm like, I know it's a modern story, but they just, maybe men are just going back to like being men in the
Man.
woods. They're being men. Well, I don't know. I think I might like that if my wife kicked me out. I don't have a wife, but like, maybe that's a better ending for them. But,
Yeah. Yeah. That's an older story too,
Is it?
actually. Yeah, some of these stories I wrote a long time ago and some of them much more recently. But can't remember when that was written, but I would say at least 8 or 9 years ago.
Well, it fit in the context of this that whole light and dark imagery for sure, because they're going through the woods and there's this light. So I mean, I'm not saying it didn't fit. That was the one that I just kept on going, I don't quite get that one. But maybe because I'm not a man in the woods getting kicked out by my wife.
Right,
That could
exactly.
be it. Let me go back to Build a Coffin, since that's one of my favorites. But it's kind of macabre. Well, it is macabre. But I thought that and Welcome to Monroe, with both are like really in the horror genre to me. And How to Build a Coffin, you could have gone in a totally different direction and totally gone into horror. And I'm a huge fan of horror. And I'm like, is that a possibility? Is that something that you might explore? I mean, you run the gamut. You got children's stories, you got a memoir. Why not?
If I could bear it, you know, if I am such a weak-kneed person because I can't even watch a trailer for a horror movie without
Uh-uh.
plopping down in my seat. Yeah, I'm scared to death. Just, you know, even you say horror movie and I'm thinking, I don't know if I can do this. It's just, I'm not that guy. I'm not, have nothing against it for sure, and I think that it's incredible the way that it's able to elicit emotions from a reader, and it's just words on a page or images on a screen. But that story is a really a love story.
Yeah, it is. At first, it didn't feel like that, but it's, at the end, you realize it's a love story. But I said a lot of these were love stories because it was about so much loss there,
And also, I would have you think about when the nature of that story, when you call it macabre, which is not inaccurate in one hand. On the other hand, what you have in that story is a man whose wife is dying, and he's building her coffin, but he's describing it as though he were on a DIY show. And so, in a sense, that brings an element of humor to it. I've
It
always,
is. There is some fun. There is some dark humor to that one, for sure. But it is the detail that he goes into and the type of wood you have to use. And this is his final act of love for her, So it makes it sad, but there's this part of my brain because I love horror, and there are so many subgenres that you can explore that I hope you do someday. That doesn't have to be like slasher, it doesn't have to be like that, but like weird fiction. I would say even some of this, what you're writing, would fall under weird fiction, which is kind of outside, all these little subgenres that you can toy with. Like right now, I'm writing, I'm calling it speculative memoir, and everybody goes, "What? What is that?" But no, I
What is
love this
that?
collection because it's all these this little collection of moments, and it felt, when I was reading it felt like, have you ever been in a car accident? Okay, so I've been in several, and there's that moment of where you know this is going to happen, and I just have to go with it. Like this is going to happen, and I'm going to get in a car wreck. And I felt like that with all of these stories. Not like it's a car wreck, it's a bad thing, but like it's like that in and out sort of sensation you had, like we're gonna go there. So I really love that. But if there are there any stories that are your favorite in here, one or two, that's hard, isn't it?
Let me see. I have to say, and you know, this is I've never said this really about a book, but that I wrote, but I really love this book.
I do too.
It's got so much in it. It's got so many different kinds of stories and just a really wonderful collection of a really wonderful collection of characters. And but I'm looking now on gosh it so I'm not going to answer the question what I because it kind of undermines the whole
The other source,
collection.
you
And
can
I
say,
don't
could
want
you
to forget
say
it.
tough too? You could, or hint at it.
When I do a reading from this, I don't plan which stories I'm going to read. And I just look at how kind of take the temperature of the room and read those stories. At one reading, somebody was there who had been at another reading. And she and I were talking, And she said, gosh, you know, they're just, I just feel like they're all about death. All these stories are about death. And I changed my lineup after she said that to read all the sex stories in here.
That always gets everybody.
There's a ton of sex stories in here.
Yeah, there are. Well, would if I is this putting you on the spot, could you read one if it's really, really short? Okay, there's one that's a paragraph because we're gonna wrap up soon. I'm not gonna keep you much longer, but if you, I mean, whatever you want to read, but there is that one, the big curve that is a paragraph, but you could also.
Why don't we read that one because it's so
Yeah.
short?
Thank you for doing that. I put you on the spot.
No, it's totally good. Okay. The big curve. The last time I saw my dad, he was wearing a toupee that looked like a year's worth of dryer lint, a Dallas Cowboys t-shirt, green golfing shorts, and penny loafers with actual pennies in them. No socks. He was waving at my wife and me as we drove away in the car he had just given us. He said he wouldn't be needing it anymore. I watched him in the rearview mirror down the long driveway and into the street until he stopped waving, his arm slowly dropping to his side, and then watched him watch us as we disappeared around the big curve, the hairpin, where who knows how many lives had been lost. Lost, we called them, as if they might be found again one day. I told my wife, when I was a kid, we weren't allowed beyond the big curve on our bikes. He thought it was just too dangerous. Always had to turn around when we got here, go back home. He watched us go. He waited for our return.
There
Yay.
you go.
Yeah, that's the
Thank
first time
you.
I've read that story, so I've enjoyed
Oh,
that.
I thought if I could sneak one in the time period that we had, that would be the one. But so I think we'll end right there because how better can you end? But I just want to say on behalf of Broadleaf Writers Association, thank you so much for the work that you've given us over the years. Thank you for playing along with me. Our 10th annual, yeah, I put this plug in, our 10th annual Writers Conference is September 20th and 21st. At Decatur Library in Atlanta, Georgia, where Daniel Wallace will be. What? No, I'm just kidding. But in the future, we would love to have you for sure. If ever in
Thank you.
Atlanta, please hit me up. And Broadleaf, but we really do value your time and value this, this little interview is it means a lot to me. So
Yeah, well,
you have a good night.
yeah, it's good to talk to you. Thank you
Yeah.
so much.
All right. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.